Welcome to the Be Well Buzz podcast, your number one weekly source for natural health and wellness.
This is your resident nutritionist, Sean Stevenson. Recently, I was brought to a quote from Dr. Martin Rossman that said, "The human mind is the most underutilized and poorly utilized resource available to us." Basically, we're just completely bypassing likely the most powerful mechanism that can help us in healing. And not only that, this is a powerful mechanism in our vitality and the energy we experience every day, in our success in life, and our overall experience of life itself. And today I've brought on an expert in this field to actually help us to identify how our mind and how our thoughts and emotions actually do play a huge part in our healing process. And today I have for you Dr. Larry Birkelhammer. He himself was actually diagnosed with several chronic illnesses and says that individuals have the ability to manage their pain very, very well, if not eliminated, with mind training techniques. And today, 133 million Americans, that's nearly half of all adults in America, live with some form of chronic medical condition, and this is according to the CDC. And Dr. Birkelhammer has spent 19 years treating clients in private practice using psychotherapy, applied psychophysiology, and applied psychoneuroimmunology, and that's something I'm really, really fascinated about and we're going to talk about today. And Dr. Birkelhammer teaches how to live well with serious conditions on his Mind Training to Improve Your Health blog at www.larryberkelhammer.com. And this is completely tailor-made for people who are living with chronic medical challenges. They want to be able to grasp and get some help in how to manage these things and actually set themselves up to be able to maximize their health and wellness. So I'm excited to bring him to you, Dr. Birkelhammer, as he liked me to call him, Larry. Larry, how you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me on your show.
Fantastic, fantastic. I mean, just your knowledge base, and I got to see quite a bit of your work, and I'm really excited about talking about this stuff. And one of the first things that I want to dive right into is, you know, we really bypass or look past the fact that our thoughts and our emotions have an effect on our bodies. So basically, my first question would be, what are some of the ways that our cognition affects our physiology?
Well, I think a way that everyone, virtually everyone, has had some experience with, not just people with chronic illness, but virtually everyone, and that is headaches, belly aches, back aches are something that seem to be brought on very often by emotional distress. And it's just so common to have this experience that we find ourselves stressing out about something, and the next thing we know, depending on who we are, our personal physiology, we develop either a headache or a bellyache or a backache or some other condition that we have, like arthritis, suddenly gets exacerbated. For example, I've got various forms of arthritis, and I can tell when I'm stressed out about something, I actually start feeling pains in my joints. And then when I calm myself, the pain actually goes away.
Yeah, I just actually had that experience with a client today. He came in. He hasn't had an experience of arthritis in about 4 or 5 months since he's been working with me. And then today, randomly, he came in, and he's like, "I can't really move my hand." And immediately, I dove in to look at, okay, what's going on nutritionally? What's going on with the stress in his life? You know, what are the hidden things that are coming up and causing this to manifest? Because it's more of a symptom or a side effect of something else on a deeper level. So something I'm picking up, so basically, do our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, are they actually affecting the cells in our body?
You know, I've trained with many people in this field, and one of the people I trained with was Jean Ochterberg, a physiological psychologist, and she said, this is what she said, And I really love this. And other people have said similar things, but here's what she said. No thought, no emotion is without biochemical, electrochemical activity. And that activity leaves no cell untouched.
When I hear something like that, I don't think that people can really grasp how powerful that is, that every single cell in our body basically is intimately impacted by the thoughts that we're carrying around and the emotions that we carry. And I guess to give us a more of a deeper understanding of it, because we know it kind of, you know, intuitively if we really think about it, but how about, can you please explain the biochemistry of a stressful thought, for example?
The biochemistry of a stressful thought is incredibly complex because there are so many different things that come into play. So first, a stressful thought appears in the frontal cortex. That's the front part of the brain where we do conscious thinking.
Right.
The frontal cortex triggers the hypothalamus to secrete a peptide or a protein known as CRF, corticotropin releasing factor, and this happens within seconds. The corticotropin releasing factor then acts on the anterior pituitary gland. Then, within about 15 seconds, the anterior pituitary releases ACTH, adrenocorticotropic hormone. When adrenocorticotropic hormones are substances that act at a distance, they are secreted into the bloodstream and they go to different parts of the body and have an effect on target organs. So the anterior pituitary releases ACTH into the bloodstream, and the adrenal glands, in this case, are the target organs. So the ACTH then almost immediately reaches the adrenals. Then within a couple of minutes, the ACTH causes the adrenal cortex, that's the more superficial part of the adrenal glands, to secrete several hormones, including cortisol. Cortisol is one of the most commonly known stress hormones, into the bloodstream. The release of cortisol, the stress hormone, into the bloodstream then triggers the pituitary to increase or decrease adrenocorticotropin hormone, depending on the level of cortisol, the stress hormone. So this is a feedback loop, and this feedback loop gets interrupted during extreme emotional distress, and that results in continued release of cortisol into the bloodstream. So it just keeps feeding on itself. So the increased sympathetic activity, the sympathetic nervous system is that part of the nervous system most commonly known as the fight or flight part of the nervous system.
Right, right.
So the increased sympathetic activity in the autonomic nervous system then signals the adrenal medulla. The medulla is a more inner part of the adrenal glands to secrete epinephrine into the bloodstream. You can see it's a very complex process, and we tend to think of our thoughts as just thoughts, like, oh, I think all day long, I'm having thoughts. You can't not be thinking. We're thinking all the time, and when we realize that our thoughts are affecting our physiology, it can be pretty frightening because, you know, if we think, oh, I'm angry, I'm, you know, like, let's say, think of the last time you felt terror. Hopefully it wasn't too often or too recently, but when you feel terror, think of all the changes that go on in your body. That's from just having a thought about something. It could be in your imagination. It may not be something real. In fact, this is what happens more often than not. Stick with terror, it's pretty rare that most of us in today's modern society are confronted with truly terrifying situations every day. Mostly, they're in our mind. In fact, Mark Twain once said something that I just love. He said, I lived through a lot of terrible things in my life. Fortunately, most of them never happened.
Exactly.
Every time we have these thoughts, it is either positively or negatively affecting our state of health.
Absolutely. You know, this is something that it gets overlooked oftentimes. And thank you so much. I really like the audience to grasp how deep this stuff goes. You know, you just went through a pretty complex outline of how a thought actually affects our physiology and the things that start to be secreted in our bodies based off of a thought that we have. You know, and then, of course, the associated feelings that are generated via that thought. You know,
right.
It's actual, very real, and due to the specific hormones. And you mentioned, of course, that the sympathetic nervous system is getting activated with that stressful thought. It could be a thought of, you know, I'm worried about my child coming home, or, you know, I'm worried about this bill that I have to pay, or I'm
right.
really stressed out about this project. And that's eliciting the sympathetic system, which is built into us from our biological evolution for fight or flight, you know, literally
right.
dire life or death situations. And now today,
right.
we're very rarely faced with situations like that. And like you just mentioned, with that great quote from Mark Twain, we're often generating or creating these very elaborate negative situations in our mind and eliciting these responses in our body. And the thing is that I want people to walk away with, and that, you know, I'm so interested in your work about, is that this is creating a situation where we're getting to a very catabolic state. You know, our body's literally starting to break itself down, and it's moving all of the blood and circulation.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt you for a second, because when you mentioned we're going into a catabolic state, I want to just give you a quote from someone else I trained with, Eric Pepper, a psychophysiologist. He said, negative attributions lead to catabolism. Healthy attributions lead to anabolism. And what that means is we attribute things to things that may not be real. And so, for example, we make up stories in our heads about why things are a certain way, why people are a certain way. When we attribute negative things, then that's a catabolic state. In other words, that the body is breaking down. When we attribute healthy attributions to what someone said or did or some situation, that leads to anabolism, which is a building up of the body.
So that's going to be eliciting the parasympathetic system, is that correct?
Yeah, so anabolism would tie in more to the parasympathetic, although it's not quite that simple, because if we are truly faced with real danger, then we are sympathetically stimulated. In other words, the fight or flight part of the nervous system is stimulated, and there's actually anabolism, the positive piece, going on while we're sympathetically aroused, because we need that in order to be able to run or in order to be able to fight.
But I guess it's just, again, having practices to keep these things in balance, because oftentimes I guess they're just kind of running on an unconscious level. We're really not really understanding how powerful our thoughts are.
That's
and how
the
they
problem.
Affect our healing.
That's
yeah.
the biggest problem, is that we are usually unconscious. I mean, not literally. I mean, we're awake, we're walking around, but we go through most of our days not fully aware of what thoughts are in our head, and we're just acting out on these thoughts. And that's why we're so often, all of us, acting out unhealthy behaviors.
So what your practice is and what you advocate is something called mind training. So please talk about mind training and how can that actually improve our health?
So the more conscious we can be, so for example, let's say we're engaging in unhealthy behavior. Someone could tell us, oh, that's unhealthy, you need to change your behavior. But we're not likely to stick with it until we become fully aware of what's leading us to that unhealthy behavior. Very often we're just acting out of bad habits. And so we need to become aware of it. And the best way to become aware of our thoughts is through mindfulness practice. And mindfulness practice can be learned at any Buddhist meditation center, and they're found all around the world. Can also be learned in MBSR classes. MBSR stands for Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. It's most normally referred to as just MBSR, and it's an 8-week class. And those classes are now found pretty much in every metropolitan area around the world now. And so mindfulness teaches us, through quieting the mind, to be able to focus on an object, often the breath, the physical sensations of breathing, and to then notice every time the mind wanders away from the sensations of breathing, or wanders away from whatever the object of attention is. And then we bring the mind back. Now, that's a concentration practice, but in true mindfulness practice, we not only bring the mind back to the object of focus, but in mindfulness practice, unlike a concentration practice, we notice where did the mind go. And we learn to do this non-judgmentally. So we see, oh, my thought went off to this thing I have to go to tomorrow. It might be an invasive medical procedure. And we notice that, oh, that's where my mind went. And when my mind goes there, I feel a knot in my stomach or some other symptom. And to just then bring the mind back to focusing on the sensations of breathing, and to not judge that the mind went to that place, to just accept that this is what our minds do. Our minds are like, you know, George Carlin came out with a book, the comedian George Carlin from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, came out with a book later in his life called Brain Droppings. And I love to think of our thoughts as nothing but brain droppings, because we tend to give too much credence to our thoughts. We tend to interpret our thoughts as reality, and that gets us into deep, deep trouble. For example, let's say, you know, we're all brought up in cultures with a lot of bigotry and prejudicial thinking. So if we're not aware that those are just our thoughts, we end up acting on those thoughts and acting in ways that are harmful to other people. If we become aware that, oh, these are just my thoughts, then I can step back from the thoughts and I don't have to act on them, which makes life so much nicer for other people to be around us, and a lot better for our health and everyone's health who's around us.
Absolutely. You know, I think that that's so important for people to understand that it's really not about trying to control your mind. That is like seriously trying to, you know, run up a hill with, you know, a 10,000 rock on your back, pound rock on your back. It's really pointless. You're not getting anywhere. It's
right.
Really about being mindful and understanding that our minds are infinite. And what we can do is actually, it's kind of like being a herder of our minds, like being somebody who's able to herd and kind of guide our minds the way that we would want, rather than to go. And you said it very, very eloquently, and I appreciate that. Just being, let the stuff be very fluid, and it's, you
yeah.
said, brain droppings. So just,
you know,
understanding that.
There's someone who, another person I'd like to quote, Willis Harmon was a professor at UC Berkeley, and he once said, perhaps the only limits to the human mind are those we believe in.
Exactly.
So whatever we believe, if we believe we can succeed at something, we're more likely to succeed. And if we believe we can't succeed at something, we're more likely to fail. The mind is that powerful.
I think that's a good place to bring up the scientific basis of the placebo effect. So can you explain what is the placebo effect?
So the placebo is used by the pharmaceutical industry. What they do, if they want to test the efficacy of a new drug, they divide people into two groups, and they're randomized. No one knows, not even the experimenters know who's in which group, and not even the experimenters know which patients are getting which, either the real drug or the placebo, because what they do is they make tablets that look identical to the real drug, only there's no active ingredient in them. So they discover most of the time that about a third of the people, there's a variation here, but about a third of the time, the people in the placebo group get the actual effect, the expected effect of the drug, including the side effects. They actually get all the side effects. There was a study done in the, I think it was in the 1950s. You could never do this today. It wouldn't be ethical, but back in the 50s, a lot of weird and actually terrible stuff was done to people in studies. They had a group of women who had intractable morning sickness. These pregnant women were just suffering terribly with nausea and vomiting every day. And what they gave them, they brought these women into the lab, and they said, we're going to give you this drug that's a very powerful antiemetic. It will stop your nausea and vomiting. It will just stop it cold, and you'll feel really good after you take this drug. What they actually gave these women was syrup of ipecac. Syrup of ipecac is a drug that traditionally was used to induce vomiting. If let's say a child swallowed something that's harmful, they would induce vomiting to get rid of the poison using syrup of ipecac. So they told the women, we're giving you this powerful drug that's going to stop your nausea and vomiting, when in fact they gave a drug that usually causes it, and all the women got better. They felt great. The nausea and vomiting ceased totally. That's the power of the mind, and that's the power of placebo.
Well, then, first of all, I want people to walk away understanding that we oftentimes look over or negate how powerful the placebo effect is. Literally, you just stated approximately one-third of people responding to something that it's just a suggestion. It's a suggestion. It's not an actual biochemical compound, an active ingredient doing something in the body, just the suggestion. And our bodies will respond in that way. It's so fascinating. And we don't want to negate that. It's so powerful. And I want people, especially in this community, to take on the understanding that oftentimes when we get our hands on the next new superfood or the great super herbs and medicinal mushrooms that are out there, a big part of that is the placebo effect, and you're believing in it, and you're believing that this thing is going to help with whatever particular symptom it is. It's very important and very powerful to allow yourself, open yourself up to that, and really get that full picture.
I'll give you an example. My wife and I take echinacea whenever we think we might be getting a cold. Well, if you look at the studies on echinacea, they haven't proven to be as effective as previously hoped for. You know, the most respected studies on echinacea show them to be not very effective in preventing the cold. And yet, even though my wife and I are both aware of the studies, we still continue to take it when we at the first hint of getting a cold. And it seems to work if we take it soon enough. Now, we both know that's the placebo working, even though we know it's the placebo effect that's helping us not get a cold. It still seems to work.
Absolutely. Well, and with that being said, let's talk about the other side of the coin. There's also something known as the nocebo effect. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, you know, one of the things is most people have heard of voodoo or faith healing. But faith healing is the positive. Faith healing would be the placebo. There are people, if people who come from a part of the world where voodoo exists, where they grew up with voodoo, if they believe a voodoo curse has been put on them, they typically die. There is a, I can't remember what country it was, but there was a country somewhere in Indonesia where the penalty for committing a crime, and they had a pretty low crime rate, but the penalty for committing a crime was everyone in the, it was a small, isolated community in Indonesia, but the penalty for committing a crime was everyone in the community stopped talking to the person who committed the crime. And typically within 30 days, that person who commit the crime was dead. Now, the person wasn't touched. All that happened was people stopped talking to them. So placebo, nocebo, it goes both ways. The most important takeaway message is that every thought we have affects every cell in the body. So we need to be aware of when we're thinking healthy thoughts and when we're thinking unhealthy thoughts.
So basically, a nocebo effect is a negative injunction. It's a negative suggestion to the degree that someone has a negative response. It's basically like a doctor saying you have 2 weeks to live kind of situation, right?
Yeah, and that, of course, becomes a voodoo curse, because a doctor, in our culture, we don't really think much about voodoo masters, because we don't really have them in our culture. But we have physicians who wear their white coats, and we empower them. We believe they have a lot of power. And so when a physician who we trust says to us, you have cancer, you have 6 months to live, we typically obey. And the reality is there are many reports, documented accounts of people being told they had 6 months to live, and sure enough, they are dead within 6 months. And there was one case I read about where this woman's mother had just died from metastatic breast cancer, very advanced stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. And soon after her mother died from advanced metastatic breast cancer, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. However, she was lucky. She was diagnosed very early. They caught it in stage 1. The doctor noticed that the woman seemed very stressed out, and he reassured her. He said, you know, you're very lucky. We've caught this very early. It's contained. We can cure you. But to her, to this woman whose mother had just died, the C word meant death. So she was given a diagnosis of early stage 1 breast cancer, and she was dead the next day. Now, what happened to her is that every cell in her body was affected by the terror that she experienced. So her organ systems, one by one, began to shut down, and she died of multiple organ failure in less than a 24-hour period from terror, from her belief that her cancer was going to kill her. Her cancer had absolutely nothing to do with what really killed her.
Yeah. You know, I oftentimes in my practice, obviously, I have clients coming in, patients coming in who've received a certain diagnosis, and they really own it, you know, because we're taught to be so suggestible to medical professionals. You know, it's very deep suggestion that gets dropped into us. And it can especially go in the negative direction most often. So we really, you know, I want to extend this out to medical practitioners, health practitioners out there, to really be conscientious of the information that you're sharing with your patients, because it has a huge impact. Oftentimes, more powerful than the medicine, more powerful than the suggested protocols that they need to take on is their mental state. And I thank you for
That's
talking
right.
about that. Next thing
yeah.
that I want to cover is this topic of psychoneuroimmunology. You know, what is that?
Well, you know, that term was coined, I think it was coined by George Solomon, an early researcher who was one of the many people, and one of the other early ones was Robert Ader. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit about psychoneuroimmunology, or PNI for short, is. It's So the first part of the word, psycho, means the psyche, the mind. Neuro means the brain. Immunology refers to the immune system. Now, a lot of people claim we shouldn't even be using the word psychoneuroimmunology. It should actually be more like psychoneurocardiogastronephroreno, you know, because the fact is the mind affects every part of the body. But anyway, let me tell you about Robert Ader's study. He paired a poison with a negative stimulus. And when he then later gave the negative stimulus, by the way, this isn't with people, this is with rats. So he later found he was able to just administer the negative stimulus to the rats, and they reacted physiologically as if they'd been given the poison. In PNI, the body gets the message that it's received a poison. And then, even when you're no longer giving the body the poison, if the body believes it's getting the poison, it will react physiologically as if it's still getting the poison. And that's PNI, or psychoneuroimmunology. It's the connection between the brain, the mind, and the immune system. And really, it's the connection with all our systems. And that's why when you start thinking about something, stressing about something, and you get a bellyache, that's because there are a lot of neurons in the GI tract, in the gastrointestinal tract, the immune system. We have more immune cells in the GI tract than anywhere else. And you might wonder why. And I think it's because in early days when, you know, a primitive man was just eating stuff without cooking it and picking it up off the ground, we needed to have a strong immune system in the gut to kill the bacteria or parasites or other pathogens. So anyway, PNI is about the connection between the mind, the brain, and I would say the functioning of all our organ systems.
Okay, got it. So we now have a really broad understanding, and we've pinpointed a few things about how our thoughts and our feelings are affecting our health, and as well as the, you know, the outpicturing of our vitality. Now, the question remains now, you know, for everybody to walk away with, you know, what do we need to do to actually feel in control of our health and our lives, regardless of any health challenges that are going on?
Yeah, this is what I've given a lot of thought to. There are a few things. One of the things, I mentioned mindfulness. I mean, we talked about that earlier. I would put mindfulness at the very top because we need to become aware of all the unhealthy ways we're thinking throughout the day. So that can be accomplished through training in mindfulness. But that's not enough. There's much more than that. And the thing I would put, the second most important thing is to become a contributing member of a supportive community. There's been a lot written about social support, especially in the PNI literature. There are studies after study where they have seen that the people who have the greatest social support seem to have a health benefit just by being part of a supportive community. Now, in recent years, a new piece of information has come along, and that is that it's not enough to just get good social support, that it's more important to be a contributing member of a supportive community, that when we help other people, whether you call it altruism or volunteer work, when we help other people, when we do good things for other people, we are not just helping the other person, we're helping ourselves. The people who do the most, this has also come up in studies, the people who do a lot of volunteer work tend to have better health than people who don't do any volunteer work. And I haven't been doing any volunteer work, and whenever I think about that, I think, wow, I better start doing volunteer work, because that's something that has proven to be a healthy practice, just going out, even if it's simple things, you know, just holding the door open for someone. I've given a lot of thought to this thing, this altruism question. What is it about that? And I have my own belief on it, and that is simply that when we help other people, our hearts open. And when I say our hearts open, I'm not speaking just metaphorically. I'm speaking physiologically. When when you get stressed out, what happens is our blood vessels contract. There's vasoconstriction. That's when we're more likely to get a heart attack or a stroke. However, when we relax, when we feel the emotion of love, when we feel open-hearted towards our fellow human beings, we say, the term that's used is warm-hearted. We feel warm-hearted. Well, that's a physiological response. What that is actually a vasodilation of the coronary arteries, which means we're less likely to get a heart attack, less likely to get a stroke, because there's vasodilation in the brain. So by doing volunteer work, by holding the door open for someone, by reaching out and helping strangers in particular, more so than family members, because with family members it can get complicated. It can be more like an obligation. But reaching out and helping and serving strangers, what that does is it actually causes vasodilation in us, in the helper. So that's a big thing.
Okay, so we've got mindfulness, becoming a contributing member of a social community.
Yep.
Is there anything else?
Oh, well, there are a lot of things. I would say the third most important, what I would consider the third most important thing is the power of choice. I used to facilitate support groups for people with chronic illness. And what I found, and I visited a lot of chronic illness groups, and what I found in there is people would come into the group and talk about all the things that were wrong with them. Now, it can be very healing to talk about what's wrong with you and hear and know that the people listening really know from personal experience what you're going through. That's wonderful. However, there's a downside to that. And the downside is that they began, from the way they were talking and talking to each other, they began to think of themselves as powerless, as victims. And victim thinking is not good for our health. It's very, very bad for our health. So one of the most powerful things we can do for our health is to recognize how powerful we are. I recommend a practice, and here's the practice I recommend. Every night, before you go to bed, think of your schedule for the next day and preface. So maybe pick three things that you're going to be doing the next day. Or if there's one particular thing you're going to be doing that you're particularly not looking forward to, like recently I had to go in for a repeat EGD and colonoscopy. EGD is where they stick the tube down your mouth into your stomach and through the duodenum. So I had to be scoped in both ends. And I wasn't looking forward to that. And I found myself thinking, oh, I got to go in for this. And then I completely turned it around. I said, no, I am choosing to go in for this. I'm the one who chose to make the appointment. I'm the one who's choosing to go in tomorrow to have this done because I'm choosing to take care of my own health. When I engage in that type of thinking, suddenly I'm very powerful. I'm the master of my destiny. Whereas if I put all the power in the doctor who's telling me you need such and such, then that makes me weak and powerless, and my doctor is suddenly the master. We need to be the masters of our own bodies, and you can be the master of your body no matter how sick you are, because even if you're in the dying phase of an advanced cancer or something, we still have the power of choice.
Well, we've got time for one more thing that we can do to really stack the conditions in our favor, if you can share one more.
Those are the most powerful, but here's one more. And this has proven out in study after study, especially in the last 10 years, the field of positive psychology has done a number of studies on gratitude practice. They have found that one antidote for unhealthy thinking is to think of a person or a situation for which you have gratitude. So, you know, let's say you arrive at work and you're not really excited to be at work. You'd rather be out doing something else outdoors. But you arrive at work and you start thinking, I don't want to be here. However, that is not healthy. Again, that's very unhealthy thinking. It's not good for the body. So you could turn that around. You arrive at work and instead think, I feel so grateful to have this job. I feel so grateful that I'm not homeless. I feel so grateful that I have a salary that I'm taking home every week. I'm so lucky to have this job. You might at times start feeling yourself engaging in unhealthy thoughts about family, you know, your child, your kids, or your partner. And you might be thinking, oh, I just sometimes wish I was alone, didn't have all these responsibilities, and then turn that around. So, you know, there are so many people out there who are completely isolated, completely alone. I'm so grateful for my family. Yeah, it may be that there's stress involved, but I'm so grateful that I have what I have. Even with health, even those of us who have all these chronic illnesses. But, you know, boy, it could be a lot worse. I feel so grateful that, you know, I have the state of health I have. So gratitude practice. And this can be a formal practice with a gratitude journal. Some studies show it's best to do this, maybe enter in your journal once a week. Personally, I practice gratitude the way I practice choice. Before bed every night, I think of what I'm grateful for. I wake up, open my eyes in the morning, and I think of what I'm grateful for.
Well, thank you, Dr. Birkelhammer. It's been incredibly insightful information, and I really want people to be able to walk away and understand how important and powerful these strategies are. You know, starting to do a gratitude journal, starting a mindfulness practice, because it's really just beginning to gain some kind of a ownership over our thoughts and our feelings and our emotions by witnessing them, by starting to see that they are not who we are. It's just something that's something that we do, if that makes sense for everybody. So where's the place, the best place for people to get in touch with your information and your resources?
So the best thing would be go to my website, www.larrybirkelhammer.com. That's BERKELHAMMER, larrybirkelhammer.com.
Thank you so much again for joining us today. And I want to wish everybody to have an incredible day and take this information, apply it in your life today, and we'll talk soon. This is Sean Stevenson signing off from Be Well Buzz. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. Go to www.bewellbuzz.com for more natural health information and subscribe to our free weekly newsletter. Don't forget to share this podcast with your family and friends. Stay tuned for more from Be Well Buzz.